Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I will not give my lecture in German. Die deutsche Sprache für mich ist nur Bremsen und Talschiebelasten und Wiener Schnitzel. Und dann passiert es ungefähr. So I will speak on recurrent respiratory papillomatosis in this building of history. It is fantastic. It's resembles the Concertgebouw building in Amsterdam with the famous heads of, here it is, medical doctors, including Rocky Tansky, I saw here, about the disease Meyer-Rocky Tansky Kusterhauser disease and hearing loss. I also wrote a paper on that, but I will not discuss that today. Today is a day of history. I looked it up. Today is exactly 55 years ago. What happened in 1968? On this date, who knows? Robert Kennedy was shot dead. So that's 5 years after JF Kennedy. And so that's history. I think that many of us will still remember the day that that happened. And well, it's already 55 years ago. And I see a lot of people older than 55 years, so I hope that they're young people as well, but I look at them here. And okay. I'm from Amsterdam, and actually I was in Amsterdam until less than half a year ago. And this is the building of the Academic Medical Center. It's of the University of Amsterdam. There's another university in Amsterdam, Amsterdam Free University, and the two university hospitals merged, and that was my task for the ENT, to merge the two departments. They were merged in the end of November, and that was for me a good reason, including the gray color of my hair, to resign. And it's an honor for me to be in Vienna, in the city where, well, indeed, Bill Roth did his first laryngectomy, and a lot of medical history was here as well. I'm here. I have two disclosures. I'm consultant for Inovio and for Karl Reiner, and you saw the name of Karl Reiner coming along in one of the previous pictures. These are the contents of my presentation, and I always want to address my presentation to the audience. Who is a doctor? Okay, so I might better ask, who is not a doctor? Okay, there are also non-doctors. Okay, that is good to hear that and to see that. Then I will not go too much in some details. I'm going to discuss the disease of recurrent respiratory papillomatosis. On one of the previous slides from Professor Svoboda, we saw that there was consideration about its origin. Was it a sequelae of laryngeal tuberculosis, or was it constitution, or was it heredity? Well, they didn't know by then, but that was, I think it was 1913 that paper was written, or I didn't see.
1923,
so exactly 100 years ago. Tuberculosis, constitution, heredity, and we don't know. Well, they couldn't because lots of my presentation will deal with that. It is a recurrent disease. That's why it has the name recurrent respiratory papillomatosis. Also, it is a sexually transmittable disease, but it's not a sexually transmitted disease. It is transmittable, but not transmitted. Treatment is predominantly surgical, but that's terrible because it recurs, so you have to operate again and again and again. And I know very well one lady, and she is the current president of the American Papilloma Association, the patient foundation, and she has been operated. She is about 61 years old now, and she's been operated more than 300 times. 300 times for one disease. So it is a terrible disease, especially for the patient, but also for the doctor, because these patients come back. And when you're young, and when you're in your 30s or in your 40s, you think you can attack the world and nobody can attack you. But those patients recur, and that makes you feel very humble, because the disease ultimately wins. So we have been working, and we are working on new developments, and that's my consultancy for Inovio, where we want to transform the disease to a medical disease and not to a surgical disease. I will come back to that in the course of my presentation. For those who are not a doctor, this is a normal larynx. And this is a larynx when you see the patient on the operating table and he's lying on his back, he or she. Every time I will say he, I can also say she, so that's for the equality. So this is the left side over here, and this is the right side. So now you see we have two vocal folds, the left vocal fold and the right vocal fold. No, that's wrong. We have four vocal folds. We have the true vocal folds, two of them, and we have the false vocal folds, also two of them. So we have four vocal folds, two false ones and two true ones. Here we go deeper. We look down, and that's the trachea. And here is the epiglottis, and the epiglottis is partly out of the picture. This is a normal larynx. Recurrent respiratory papillomatosis has a unique aspect for each and every patient, as you can see in this picture. Here, these are just six patients, so it can be a huge bulk on the posterior left side, it can be a small bulk over there, it can be a huge bulk on the true vocal fold here, expanding to the false vocal fold. It can be a small sort of a polyp. It can be bilateral, anteriorly, bilateral, posteriorly. So it's not a wolf in sheep's clothes. It's a wolf in either sheep's clothes or in mouse clothes or in rabbit clothes. Lots of varieties. And here is the cause. It's a virus. It's human papillomavirus, HPV. And HPV is a small double-stranded DNA virus. And currently there are more than 120 types, and some over 200 subtypes have been described. And it was described for the first time as a potential cause for disease by a professor who later became Professor Harald Zuhausen, and he received the Nobel Prize for it. And regrettably, I have to say that Harald Zuhausen died 8 days ago in Heidelberg, where he was still professor and where he was still doing his laboratory work. And yeah, it's sad. I have his telephone number in my cell phone, so we were in touch, and I was surprised by his death. It is a benign virus, predominantly the HPV, which causes RRP, recurrent respiratory papillomatosis, and that's caused by numbers HPV 6 and number 11. And as you can see here, there are more than 120 HPV types. And these two rarely transform malignant. But here you have many other HPV types. We have the common warts, which you can have on your finger. We have the plantar warts, which your children or grandchildren have when they walk through the swimming pool. And those warts will go away. And those plantar warts are caused by types number 1, 2, 4, and 63. And here in red are the 6 and 11, and here is the recurrent respiratory papillomatosis. But it can also cause oral papillomas, or anal lesions, or anogenital warts. So there are predominantly two places where this virus comes to expression. The most dangerous types are 16 and 18, And they have the highest risk for genital cancer, and that is the uteral cancer, the cervical cancer of the mouth of the uterus. And that is where we currently have the preventive vaccination in most developed countries. I'll come back to that. The lifetime probability for acquiring any HPV, here in the audience as well, approximately 100%. So that means, that shows that it's a sexually transmittable virus, but not a sexually transmitted virus. I also come back to that. There is a low risk virus, the HPV 6 and 11. The intermediate risks are these numbers over there, and the high risk I just addressed, the 16 and 18. The pathogenesis, and that's what 100 years ago was not known, is that we have microlesions of epithelium, and that's expressed, that is especially there after shouting or singing, and that's not the great opera singing here, but think of a soccer coach who just lost the final despite his shouting, oh, to the left, and well. And then you have microlesions on the vocal folds, and then by talking to each other or by, I'll come back to that, you can enter viruses in your mouth and in the saliva, and those viruses can enter the stem cells through the epithelium. The virus induces immune regression locally. The cells divide, and then you get multiplication of the HPV DNA. Those cells migrate to the upper layers. The cells produce variants, and they induce the wart-like lesions. So it's not, if you have the vocal fold here and there's just this small tiny lesion and you take it away, you took away all the virus. No, there's also virus here and here and on the false fold and on the other false fold and on the epiglottis. So it's, in cancer, they would call it field cancerization. And we are all inoculated with the virus, but not, it is not active in us healthy people. We used to say that there are two types, and that is the juvenile onset RRP. That is very rare. That is 1 to 2 children per million children per year. And these children are, by definition, less than 18 years old, or other definition, less than 16 years old. But that is not so important because 75% gets it before they are 8 years. This form of papillomatosis tends to be more severe than the adult form, more often tracheal cannulas, and there is more disease burden. The adult onset is about 5 per million per year, which means here in the city of Vienna, some 1 million inhabitants, 5 new patients in this town per year. By definition, over 18 years. But here we see a male preponderance. Literature says 2 to 1, 2 males to 1 woman. In my group of patients, I have 250 patients in Amsterdam, and there's 4 to 1 male preponderance. We don't know why. It tends to be milder, but the adult form is not just an adult form. Here is the age from left to right. And this is the number of patients. And here you see the juvenile peak, and then you see the young adult peak at approximately 35 years of age. And then we see the senior adult peak, and that is 55 to 65 years of age. And that is in Europe, and that is, I have compared it with a South American laryngologist where it's completely different, but that is just a consequence of the population pyramid, where in Europe it's like this and in Africa it's like this, and there are almost no people of 65 years or older. transmission of HPV, of the virus in the oral cavity, and we published that this year, is there are four main routes. The first route is where the source of HPV infection is in the female genitals, and it's transmitted to the infant, and that is in the perinatal period. And that's not only during delivery, it can also be transplacental and even during caesarean section. That is a very frequent way of transmission of the virus. We have a pathway of auto-inoculation, where you have the virus in your genital area and you transmit it to the oral cavity, and that can happen in the males and in the females. That is quite rare, and it's possibly via the hands. Then the most frequent route is transmission of HPV from the genital area, the male or the female genital area, to the oral cavity of the male or female. So that's the genital-oral pathway. There are risk factors for that. That's a homosexual relationship. That's a high number of partners. And then you don't need to think of prostitutes with over hundreds, but it's like more than eight partners, then you are at a seriously higher risk level than one or two partners. And oral genital sex is a transmission way. And then we have the oral-oral way from male to male or male to female and vice versa. That's quite rare, but that's the deep kissing, the French kissing. And those are the four pathways of the virus. And I am sure, I look at the audience, I'm sure all of us have been confronted with at least one of these routes. So that's why we all are positive for this virus. The clinical presentation of this very rare disease, again, 1 to 2 per million children per year, or 5 adults per million per year. So it's very rare, but they come back and come back and come back. So therefore, it's important for the doctor, but also for those patients. If I have to tell my patient that he or she has to be operated for the 106th time, it's a terrible announcement. They have dysphonia, so they have bad voices. They talk like this with very much tension. And if you are a lawyer and you have to plea to a judge, it is extremely difficult, and the judge will not take you seriously. Respiratory distress, because you have the lesions growing there, so there's less space for air to go through. So the patients sit and they have to breathe like that. But now I talk with my voice. But they talk like this. They could eat. Okay. That's not a pleasant way to live. And actually, it's terrible. It presents in the larynx, but it can also present subglottic and more distally in the trachea and in the lungs. That's 1 to 6, 1 to 4 patients. Pulmonary involvement, 3%. And you never cure. I personally had a patient who was operated. I'll show him later, his operation record. He was operated many times until he was like 20, 25. And then there was an interval of more than 32 years, something like 32 and a half or 33 years, without disease. And then he returned to my outpatient clinic and he had his voice again. It's just like it was 30 years ago. And I had to repeatedly operate him again. We see that HPV-11 gives a more severe disease, a more severe disease than HPV-6. As opposed to earlier mentioned in literature, there's no increased risk for cancer in the HPV-11, so that is the only good thing we can tell the patient. But we inform the patient what type they have, because it gives some light to the direction the disease will go. We see that the HPV 11 comes on more locations. So you always come with the first location in the vocal folds, because that affects your voice. If it's on the false vocal folds, it doesn't affect your voice. So you don't come. So it grows bigger and bigger, and you still don't come. And then either you get a second wart, or you get breathing difficulties. You don't show up to a doctor. The younger you get it, the more severe it gets. That's what we described in 2015. And we see that in the beginning of the disease, there are multiple recurrences, and the number of recurrences usually diminishes. But you still have an increase of number of interventions, of course. But in the first year, you can have like 20 surgical interventions, and then the next year, only 15. And then only 10, which means only once a month you have to go in general anesthesia. There's no relationship between gastroesophageal reflux disease and papillomatosis. And as you can understand by just showing the voice and the breathing, there are multiple psychosocial complaints affecting quality of life. And in the United States, last summer, a study showed that it severely affects income. Patients usually have, the majority of patients spends more than 5% of his income to the disease, and that is terrible. When you have pulmonary RRP, which is rare, only 3%, but then you have a very high increased lifetime risk of malignant transformation in the lungs. So when you have it in the lungs, you might get lung cancer in a high probability. We can take it away with surgical instruments. We call it cold instruments. That's just forceps and scissors. We can use a laser, a carbon dioxide laser. That's general anesthesia. Or a microdebrider, and that's this ingenious device over here, where you have two metal tubes. This is from here to here, it's 3 millimeters, and the inner tube rotates 25 times per second, and there's suction. So the moment there's an opening, the tissue is sucked in, and it rotates, and it is cut off by these teeth over here, and then it closes again, and then it opens, new tissue sucks in, and you cut it away. You can never go too deep because the thick tissue is not being sucked into this microdebrider. We have additional ways of doing it in the office, and that's with the KTP laser, blue laser, and coblation. I will not go too deep in that. But in the office, you do it like this. The patient is awake. The doctor doesn't look at the patient, but the doctor looks at the screen. Here is a laser application, a laser fiber going into the endoscope. You have very good view, but the patient is moving, and the patient is coughing, and the patient is swallowing. So therefore, you have limited surgical access, and you have limited time because your local anesthesia doesn't work indefinitely. And there's potential HPV contamination for the doctor. There are multiple pathways for the general anesthesia. There's the conventional orotracheal intubation, and that is with this tube in here, and you ventilate over there. But of course, you have a limited view, and you have limited surgical access. There's optimal surgical time, there's no chance of contamination, but when you use a laser, the tube can set fire, so that is really a high danger. You can do unconventional orotracheal intubation, and then you use a very small tube. Here you almost can't see it, and it's over here, so it's a small tube. But still, you don't have complete sight, so it's still a limited view. For the rest, you have the good things over here. You can do an unconventional tube with a laser tube, and the laser tube is protected against lasers, so the laser can burn on it and nothing happens, it will not set fire. But you have limited surgical access. You can do recurrent apnea and intubate the patient, and then I say, okay, no, then the anesthesiologist says, okay, there's enough oxygen in the patient. We take the tube out, and now I have complete access, fantastic visibility, but there's potential contamination, and of course I have limited time. I have just 2-3 minutes, and then I need to reintubate the patient again. Spontaneous breathing, patient is asleep, but breathing spontaneously, the tube can be here. There's slightly limited surgical access because the tube is over here. But there's still, at this moment, the high risk of tube fire because we need high oxygen concentrations with this open access. And therefore, we have the high-frequency jet ventilation with a tube in there, and there's slightly limited view and partially limited surgical access. But you can sort of explode the patient with a pneumothorax because you have a closed airway. And now we have the supraglottic high-frequency jet ventilation, and that was invented by Karl Reiner. I saw Heinrich Reiner. I have to learn the difference between those two. Must have been brothers. But you have unlimited view, unlimited surgical access, good surgical time, but on the backside, potential HPV contamination. And that is, of course, difficult. There is scientific work to be said on this topic. No tube fire, no pneumothorax. Here are the surgical interventions. This part, the left part, is the HPV-6 patients, more HPV-6 patients than HPV-11 patients. This is the patient I talked about, 200 interventions up till he was 20 years old. Then 35 years of interval, and there several interventions again. Some patients, you have one intervention and 20 years nothing, and then two interventions. This patient has more and more and more interventions. You see, it can start at the age of 1 year or 0 years, and it can start at the age of, 80 plus years. So we're not yet safe, the audience over here. We're trying to get to adjuvant medical treatment, and there are four medications which are important in that. That's cidofovir, Gardasil, bevacizumab, and ENO-3107. These ones have been tried but are not important. Cidofovir is an analog of DNA, and of cytosine, and therefore the DNA can't replicate. It is off-label, and it is then given intralesionally. So you take a needle, and you stick the needle into the papilloma. But I told you, if you have a papilloma here and here, and you stick the needle in there, there can be virus over here. And if you get a microlesion over here, next time you get a papilloma over here, where you didn't put the cidofovir. There's no increase to the risk of laryngeal dysplasia. There are no systemic side effects. We've been using it now for 15 years or so. And only if you have pulmonary involvement, you administrate it intravenously. Gardasil seems very, very nice. It's a vaccine which is given to children who are not yet sexually, of whom the government's governments think that they are not yet sexually active, that is 12 years of age. And the original Gardasil was to four viruses, 6-11, that's the RRP and the anal warts and the anal condylomata, and 16-18, and that is the cervical cancer. But we use it as a treatment, and the treatment, conceptually, it cannot work, but effectively it works, and there now have been two meta-analyses which support its use as an adjuvant treatment. In Australia and USA, they gave the Gardasil 9 to the young children, and there we see a huge decline in the incidence of RP, and in Australia for 2 years there have been no new patients, and that is fantastic. The future, we expect that increasing vaccination uptake, which is now most countries like 60%, increasing uptake might lead to elimination of HPV-related disease, which would be extremely nice. Bevacizumab is a monoclonal antibody, and it's binding to VEGF, and that is a vascular endothelial growth factor. It inhibits this growth factor, and therefore disrupts tumor angiogenesis, so it's an oncologic medication. We give it systemically, it's off-label, and 1 or 2 years ago we've written an international consensus statement when to give it, and if you want to see it, well, just look up my name and Delphi method and you will find it. ENO-3107, it was published for the first time, you're the first audience I'm telling this to. It was published May 19 in Laryngoscope. It is an investigational DNA immunotherapy. It is designed to elicit targeted T cell responses against HPV 6 and HPV 11. So it is explicitly against RRP. It's delivered by intramuscular injection 4 times. And the first phase 1-2 study, single-arm open label, has been published now in 8 sites in the United States, 21 patients. And it seems to work. And tomorrow, 2 weeks, so 15 days from today, I will be in Milan, where we will discuss the European start of a prospective study on the use of ENO-3107. So in the future, RP should become an internal disease and not a surgical disease, as that would be fantastic. We do not understand the disease. Here we see this patient. This is during stroboscopy. We take pictures during one cycle, and it seems to be on the left side, but here you see that it's on the posterior right side as well, and there. And we saw this quite large lesion, and 6 weeks later, the patient was on the operating table, and it was gone forever, or forever. It's now 15 years ago, and it never returned. So apparently, local immunity played an important role. Ladies and gentlemen, this enigmatic disease is extremely interesting. I regret the fact that I had to retire now on my age and that I will not fulfill this story of getting it into a medical disease. If you're ever in Amsterdam, don't be surprised by the bicycles and the old houses. I'd love to meet you there. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Professor Dinkins, for this extremely comprehensive lecture, which spans history and also the future. For us, it's very important because we deal with a rare disease which accompanies the patient for a lifetime. So a collection of abstract and also lived experience is extremely important. Thank you for coming to Vienna. Please, discussion.
I never understood clearly why the vaccination is recommended only for children or young people, and why not for elderly people?
Vaccination is important for children because we think they have not been as exposed as much as the adults. And when people are sexually active, then for sure they have been exposed to these viruses. And then it doesn't work as a preventive medication anymore. In my country, they're now doing a sort of regret group. They started like 8 years ago for children who were then 12, and they are now 20. And now we're doing one group of 20 to 26. My future daughter-in-law is 27. And she will not get it because they say she is too old. So on the other hand, I have been vaccinated myself, because as a surgeon, I have been exposed to these patients approximately 2,000 times now, maybe 3,000, that order. And every time I inhaled their air in the office while they were sitting opposite me or during the intervention, so I've had thousands of contacts with them. And we've discussed that, and after a German study, some 2-3 years ago, I decided and I propose doctors and medical personnel involved with treating these patients to be vaccinated as well. But for older people in the street, it is not necessary.
Thank you for your presentation. It's very good for us. So I want to ask, there are three types of vaccine at now. Vaccine for two type of human papillomavirus, or four type for human papillomavirus, and also 9 type is in America for tomorrow. But my question here, human papillomavirus number 11 is responsible for the vocal cord papillomatosis. If we have the vaccine number, human papillomavirus vaccine number 11, is prevented completely the vocal cord papillomatosis or not?
The vaccination currently is, it used to be 3 times, it now went down to 2 times. And that is day 0 and 6 months later. So that is the preventive vaccination in 12-year-old girls and boys, and it might go back to earlier age of 9 years. The therapeutic vaccination, which again, conceptually, should not work, I still do it 3 times, day 0, month 2, and month 8. So that is 3 times. We might go back to 2 times, but it is still a very small group, but in many countries the people need to pay it for it themselves, and it's some 400-500 euros in my country and most European countries per injection, so that's a lot of money. On the other hand, all patients have an iPhone, and that's 1,000 euros, so yeah, either a new iPhone this year or 3 vaccinations, what do you want, and be cured for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Okay, but the vaccine can completely prevent focal cord papillomatosis or not?
Yeah, it would be good to, it prevents the vocal fold, but also the cancer.
Yes, I'll speak about it. Papillomatosis is not cancer, not malignant.
No, the RP is not malignancy.
It's also completely prevent?
Yeah, we'll never know. Future will show.
Question from the internet, from the audience at home. It means you have partially responded. How high do you deem the risk for a surgeon treating respiratory papillomatosis when he works with the open double frequency superposed jet ventilation?
The reported number of surgeons having papilloma because of the fact that they are a surgeon is 2 surgeons. There is one gynecological surgeon, oncogynecological surgeon, treating genital warts, and he got HPV RP. And there is an ENT surgeon, and those 2 were published in literature. On the other hand, 5 people per million per year, let's say for 20 year, that is 100 persons. And are there 1 million surgeons? There are a lot of surgeons. So is it RP the way you and I could get it, or is it transmitted by the patient? The Norwegian surgeon from the anogenital area, it was he published himself as well. He was one of the authors. And he said he was highly exposed for many years, for many patients. And yeah, that is very, it seems very fair to attribute it to the surgical transmission. So in summary, the risk for the individual surgeon is very, very low.
Thank you. And this warrants for vaccination of treating personnel also. And that reminds some discussions of this type in the COVID time. So when discussing how to ventilate these patients, or should one attend the patient in the ward, or keeping his seating outside the intensive ward, this was oftentimes mentioned, and this is much more crucial. So it's interesting. This is an important element of discussion of prevention of respiratory transmitted infection.
Correct. And when I started my residency, I used to operate on tonsils with bare hands, even no gloves. And so did you. And now we wearing mask and a hat and a gown and everything. Was everything back in the past? Was it better, or is everything today better? We don't know, but we take many measures to prevent contamination from the patient. So I think that matter-of-factly, if you think sensibly, it is okay. But yeah, with this current current feeling that you should always blame someone and sue, I would not like to be the representative for the high frequency jet ventilator when a surgeon comes and has this papilloma, and I think I would sue him.
Yes, this is reality.
It is it is very rare. Yes, so but you never know. And I think we don't know it, so there's no scientific fact. And if you have a very good lawyer, you see what happens in Belgium last week with the when you have a good lawyer, and then you don't get any punishment. And that is that's terrible.
A question of inside discussion of our hospital regarding cancer prevention, so which is targeted to the future. Is there any evolutionary pressure by vaccination on the diversity and change of these viruses?
I speak to people who say that their mission is to eradicate HPV from the world, completely from the world. And HPV is a very lazy virus. There have been mummies, Egyptian mummies, where they were able to identify HPV from. And apparently you know what of it, and that HPV is highly similar to the current HPV. Whereas the COVID, we all knew. We had the original ones, and then we had the Delta, and then we had the Omicron. So it evolved every time, and the HPV stays very silent, so and very similar. So therefore, it might be indeed a goal to completely eradicate it.
So thank you very much. It was a great pleasure to listen to you.
Thank you.
And I think that Dr.